You are listening to Gangland Wire, hosted by former Kansas City Police Intelligence Unit Detective Gary Jenkins.
Welcome, Wiretappers. Good afternoon, and welcome to the studio of the Gangland Wire. I'm here with my good friend on Skype, Cam Robinson. Welcome, Cam.
Hey, Gary, how you doing? Glad to be here.
Oh, good. You're a big help to me, Cam. I don't have to do so much research. Folks, I've been working on another movie. It's going to be a documentary about a mob war here in Kansas City in the 70s. The other movie I did was more about the a war over some liquor licenses, but was not about a war between two warring factions, the Savella family and the Spiro brothers. So this is going to go into that in detail. I'm right in the middle of it right now. Cam's helped me with writing the script or rewriting the script for the narrator. I can write a little bit, but I need help. I need a professional writer's, a script writer's help. And Cam, I appreciate you helping me with that.
I was glad to do it. I really enjoyed reading it.
Well, we hope people like it. We will have that available here in a few months. We're doing another mob film festival, and I wanted to come up with another film. I didn't want to keep showing Gangland Wire over and over again, so I wanted to come up with another film for the Mob Film Festival here in Kansas City in November. That'll probably be the kind of the premiere of this movie, and then I'll have it online to sell. I'd like to thank a few people. Michael McCollum, for sure, made me a nice, really nice donation on PayPal. As soon as he gets me his address, we're going to have a couple things in the mail to him. We also have, I mentioned this every once in a while, the Venmo app. If you have Venmo, buy me a shot of beer and a shot of beer. that's how much I know about it. Buy me a shot and a drink, a bar, a beer. I used to work at the one of the steel plants, and there's a bar and grill just outside the front gate. And you'd go in there at 6 o'clock in the morning. These old guys would be in there getting ready, or just getting off of work, or just getting ready to go to work. And they'd get a shot and a beer, and then take that shot and down that beer and head off to work, or get another one if they were just getting off, and another one.
It's a different time.
And I couldn't keep up with those guys. But now the Venmo app, buy me a shot and a beer, or just get me a cup of coffee. A Starbucks would be nice. You know, that's an expensive coffee. But no, I'm just kidding. Yeah, you know, I just anything. Often said, if every person that ever listened to an episode of Gangland Wire would give me 50 cents, I'd be a rich man today. But that's okay. We like doing it, don't we, Cam?
Absolutely.
So we'll keep doing it. I want to thank a few people. Mark Ryan, I really appreciate it. You're a regular. You're trying to get me drunk, I think, sometimes. Thomas Price, he bought me a really expensive, nice cup of coffee at Starbucks. Got Paul Nobrega, Paul Christian, Jason Spergettis. Who else we got here? We got Alan Turner. I guess that's all I see on that particular page there. Well, that's enough. I know I've thanked a bunch of these people before, so I always like to make sure people are thanked for their support, because it's hugely important. It's not really just the money. I mean, the money's nice, but it's more knowing that people appreciate what you're doing, don't you think, Cam?
Absolutely. Knowing you got people listening and supporting what you're doing.
Yeah, if somebody will pay a little bit of money for your work, it makes it all worthwhile. It makes it a lot easier to do, and makes it easier to spend a little extra time on it. Tonight, we're going to talk about, we've been talking about the Patriarca crime family, also known as The Office, based out of Providence, Rhode Island in the Federal Hill neighborhood. And they also, what I found interesting, we learned in another episode that Raymond Patriarca actually was the crime boss over the metropolitan area of Boston from his little kind of a much smaller town of Providence, Rhode Island. Jerry Angelo, I think, and that he's mm-hmm. wasn't that his name?
Yeah.
And he was the underboss of Patriarch of Crime Family of all of Boston. And,
yes, sir.
Which then had to keep all those Irish gangs in control or make deals with them or work with them. So that would be a heck of a job. We don't have anything like that in Kansas City. And, you know, in New York and in Manhattan, they just ended up pretty much decimating the Westies.
That's right.
And the Irish gangs, they just took them all over
yeah.
and kicked them out. There was a heck of a mob war there for a while in Manhattan.
That's right.
I did one story on it about Mickey Featherstone.
That's right, down in Hell's Kitchen.
Down in Hell's Kitchen. Who was the other guy besides Mickey? Mickey Featherstone's the guy that turned on everybody, I think.
Splane Jimmy and then Coonan. Jimmy Coonan.
Yeah, Mickey Splane and then Jimmy Coonan. But they just killed them all off and took everything they had.
Yeah.
In Boston, they worked with them. They coexisted, which is probably, you make more money that way. And that's probably was Patriarca's influence, don't you imagine?
Yeah, and there was a hell of a lot more of them, too. And so they couldn't just be dismissed, you know?
Yeah, but we talked about Raymond Patriarca before, and he was more a sophisticated, as you called, more Machiavelli than Mussolini. I love that term, Cam. He was a sophisticated guy that just wanted to make money and keep the peace. You know, there's no money in running around killing people. Only if you have to, will a good mob boss do it. You see how long John Gotti lasted after he got kind of on up there.
Yeah.
But anyhow, tonight we're going to talk about a guy named William Wild Bill Grasso, who I don't know anything about. He was from Connecticut originally. I see you in your notes here. He's born in New Haven. Immigrants came from Caserta. Is that Sicily or is that just southern Italy? I can't remember.
I believe that's.
I think that's southern Italy.
Yeah.
But almost everybody.
I should have verified that for us. It's not like I know what I'm talking about.
Almost everybody that came over in the turn of the century was from southern Italy or Sicily, Naples south. You know, Al Capone was a Neapolitan.
Yeah.
So there's a few, but primarily there's a lot of people from Sicily, and they're the ones that moved into the ghetto, shall we seek, and kind of had the low end jobs, and there must have been a almost like a famine going on, and a just no opportunity at all in Sicily in turn of the century around that time.
My mother's people came over about that time. The Stichetti family came over.
Yeah, so that was, I was down, there's a city south of Kansas City about, 200 miles, the place where Joey Doves Iupa shot the 500 doves and got caught bringing them back. And that little city of Frontenac, it's got a French name, but it is an Italian town. And I started asking around, and there's a whole lot of coal mines down there. And around the turn of the century, tons of people from Sicily went through Ellis Island and came to Frontenac, Kansas, and started working in the coal mines. So there was, you know, of course, they brought the Sicilian mafia with them, some germ of it, some understanding of it, and some understanding of how you need to get along with those mafia people. Because, you know, for the rural people, the poor people in Sicily, the mafia was like their government. Mm-hmm. They were the ones that protected them. So it's little pockets all around. And I always like looking back into the, well, why? You know, I kept having people tell me, oh, there's some kind of mob influence down in Frontenac, Pittsburgh, Kansas. And I'm going, So I kind of check around and I find out, well, that's where Joey Doves Iupa went and shot all those doves. So I keep asking around, well, why is that? Why is that rumor out there? And finally, I find out that it's because so many people came from Sicily at the turn of the century to work in the coal mines.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
This guy here, Grasso, his family came over here from southern Italy.
That's Naples. Family. Caserta's Naples.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he's a Neapolitan then.
He's just, Napolitan.
He's not one of the real deal guys. I know they look down on each other to a certain greater or lesser extent.
That's right. Yeah, there is that rivalry.
We always do that, no matter what little subculture we're from. We find somebody we can look down on. Seems to be a natural human instinct, don't you think, Cam?
I agree. Yeah, that's right.
See, I'm not so bad. I could be one. Could be one of them. You know, he starts out like a lot of them during the 1920s. No jobs, very much, and he gets involved with crime. He was listed in World War II, like so many of these guys did. I always am kind of amazed when I see the obituaries of some of your lesser guys here in Kansas City, and they all served in World War II, mm-hmm. and many of them had, you know, they're bold guys, so many of them had decorations from their service time, and this guy served in World War II. Came out of that and started into a life of crime in the New Haven area. He was. You wrote down he was an associate of the Colombo family. Yeah. I wonder, do you have any idea how that happened? It was because Colombo family had that area already.
Yeah, in the early 50s, that was before Patriarca, and you know, of course, Patriarca gathered up the entire area into under one family. But New Haven and Connecticut in general was considered neutral territory. And a lot of the families, they all pretty much operated out of New Haven at the time. And it was basically split between the Colombos and the Genoveses. The Colombos ran the gambling under a guy named Tropiano. And the Genoveses ran the construction, the unions, under a guy named Midge Annunziano. So they split those rackets. From what I found out, those two guys hated each other. But they split the rackets in that city pretty evenly in New Haven. And so if you wanted to be in the mob period, there was, you know, Patriarca wasn't any, he was just in Providence, Rhode Island under a guy named Morello. So there was no office, there was no Patriarca at the time. He was just a regular guy running numbers for a guy. So the only option, really, if you wanted to be mobbed up at the time in New Haven was to start out with these Colombos, with the Colombo family. So Grasso, he started up gambling and collecting debts for the Colombo family under this guy Tropiano. But he was a pretty enterprising guy, and he ran dice games and all, but he pretty early on wanted to expand, and he put together a pretty interesting scheme. He wanted to incorporate all of the garbage industry of New Haven. And being a young guy, this was in the early 60s. He would have been in his 30s, and he's trying to put together all of the garbage carriers and form a union and run the whole garbage industry. And you know how the mobs with garbage, that's big business. And
they love garbage, mm-hmm. don't they? Tony Soprano loved garbage. It's only in the Northeast that we don't have that in Kansas City, for example. We have primarily the city runs most of the trash. Mm-hmm. Now there is
Grasso gets out of prison in 74, and he goes back to New Haven. But by now, he and Patriarca have come up with a plan. Patriarca had already been released from prison. Grasso wants to take over New Haven for Patriarca. He gets out and he realizes there's all these families operating in New Haven. He doesn't appreciate that. He thinks that should be Patriarca territory. And Raymond Patriarca agrees. He says, we run this area. We run Rhode Island. We run most of Boston. We allow the Genovese to operate there in western Massachusetts, but it's our territory. Why don't we go ahead and take over Connecticut also? So New Haven is a port city. You've got the port right there, so you've got a lot of shipping. So as soon as Grasso comes out of prison in 74, he starts. He has some issues with some local Gambino guys. A couple Gambino guys, local Gambino boss, a guy named Paul the Greaser Agresto, and he. Paul the Greaser disappears on his way to a party. A guy named John Slew Palmieri. His car blows up. And William Grasso takes over their rackets. So The Gambinos are no longer a presence in New Haven. And Grasso has taken over their rackets. A few years later, and also during this time, the Genovese boss, Annunziata, the Colombo boss, Annunziata, the Colombo boss is in prison, Tropiano, and Annunziata, the Genovese boss, is also in prison. So during this time, Grasso has no competition from the other families. He's eliminated the Gambinos, and the Genovese and Colombo bosses are in prison. So he's running New Haven alone. A few years later, in 1979, Annunziata, the Genovese, and Tropiano, the Colombo, they get out of prison, and they want their rackets back. So within a year of getting out of prison, Annunziata disappears. The Genovese capo, he disappears. He was trying to get his rackets back, and he's gone. Shortly thereafter, a soldier of his, Tommy Vastano, who was the last person to see Annunziata, he disappears also. And the thinking is that he was told by Grasso he could take over his boss's rackets, and he is found dead in his backyard. He was shot in the back of the head in his backyard.
So the last man standing is our friend, Wild Guy Grasso. Huh?
Correct.
And I think we know who the suspect was on that one.
Absolutely.
Or all of those.
Shortly thereafter, the Colombo capo is shot by two masked men on the sidewalk in Brooklyn. So the Colombo, Genovese, and Gambino are all eliminated. An FBI agent who's unidentified, he says, you know, why have we been for years in Connecticut without a hit? Now all of a sudden, we've got three guys dead within a few months of each other. Within less than a year, we've got three guys dead. And it's Grasso making moves. He's eliminating all the competition, and now New Haven is his. Everybody is dead, and he takes over. There are a couple of Gambino hitmen, freelance hitmen, a guy named Bill Shemansky and Joseph Rabbit. They are eliminated also in April. This is all in April. Three more guys who worked for the Gambinos are all killed. Also in New Haven and the surrounding areas. So the Gambinos are totally gone. The Genovese and the Colombo, everybody is wiped out.
You know, that Patriarca must have.
Yeah.
Somehow they must have come to some agreement.
Yeah.
Then been given, say, okay, you do it, you work it out if you can, and if you can't, you do what you got to do.
Yeah.
It'd have to be, wouldn't you, don't you think?
Yeah, that's where we see Patriarca's real strength and where the five families sort of, they recognized his power. We see another murder shortly thereafter where Paul Castellano reached out to Patriarca. There was a guy named Frank Piccolo, who had some struggles with the Genovese family. And, of course, Paul Castellano was working with the Genovese in New York City on a large construction project called the Javits Convention Center.
Oh, yeah, the Javits Center. Yeah, that was huge.
Absolutely.
A lot of mob money came out of that.
Massive.
Boy, they made a ton of money out of that. Yeah. They knocked off all those, the last
million.
Of those Westies over an argument over that.
Absolutely.
Money.
So Paul Castellano does not want to jeopardize the money he's making on this huge project. And this guy, Frank Piccolo, is struggling over some penny ante BS with the Genovese in Connecticut, which is not really their territory anymore anyway. So he reaches out to Raymond Patriarca and says, look, we're getting tired of this guy Piccolo. He's a roadblock for us, and he's a stumbling stone, really. If you get rid of him for us, you can have his rackets. So shortly thereafter, 1981, this Frank Piccolo, Gambino boss of Bridgeport, Connecticut, he is shot to death standing at a payphone. So clearly somebody called him, and that was a Patriarca sanctioned hit because he was a made guy, and Grasso takes over his rackets. So by this point, Grasso now has the entire state of Connecticut. He is, within a couple years, he has eliminated the Gambinos, the Colombos, and the Genovese family in Connecticut, and has expanded his empire to take over the entire state for Raymond Patriarca.
Wow. So what kind of guy was this Grasso personally? I mean, was he a flamboyant guy? Or
no, he was absolutely not. He had a terrible temper. His men really couldn't stand him. He was a real bastard. If his tomatoes weren't cut properly, he was yelling and screaming. He was a cheap dresser. Said his clothes came from Kmart. They said his shoes looked like cardboard. He stayed around the Italian section in New Haven. He had a little Italian restaurant called Franco's. Franklin Avenue is the Little Italy of New Haven.
Oh, okay.
And he lived there. They said he was a real gangster. He wasn't somebody who was flashy or showy or trying to demonstrate anybody to anything. There's one known picture of Grasso. It's just one black and white picture. You can't find anything on him. Grasso would drive 50 miles to make a phone call. He never made a long-distance phone call because if he did, there would be a record with the phone company of a long-distance phone call. So he would drive 50 miles to a payphone in another state. He would drive to Rhode Island to make a local call in New Haven, Connecticut. The FBI trailed him. He would drive him down the interstate. Here's an example. He's driving down the interstate, I-91. He would pull over on the interstate, sit there for 15 minutes. Just stop on the interstate on the side of the interstate. That way he knows if he's being followed, nobody's going to pull over on the interstate and wait for him to start driving again. I mean, what do you do? I mean, you've done surveillance on the guy. If you're following Tuffy DeLuna or somebody and he just pulls over, stops on the interstate and just sits there, I mean, what could you do?
Those guys that are real surveillance conscience are a son of a bitch to follow. If you have a full crew, you got, you know, 4 or 5 cars and an airplane up, then you can kind of follow them. But if they, like Tuffy, he used to get out and just stand there. And if a plane, he saw the same plane go in a huge big circle, because that's what they have to do. You can't get close enough to see on them or they're going to see you. So they let the plane watch them. But then the plane has to make these big lazy circles around them. And you see the plane doing that, then you know. He knew that. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've got so many techniques. We had this one guy, P.J. Robastian, and they'd pick him up leaving his house. And he lived way out in the suburbs, and he'd hit the interstate to come into town. And he would drive about 110 mile an hour, and then he'd slow way down to 10 mile an hour. And then he'd speed up to 110, and all of a sudden, slam on the brakes and slow way down. He was even harder than Tuffy. Tuffy didn't do that. Tuffy was real conscious, but that going real fast and slowing down real quick 2 or 3 times, you know, you just can't. That's almost impossible unless you have an airplane up.
Yeah.
Now today they just throw a GPS locator on there. Probably, although the feds probably have to get a court order to do it. I'd bet the locals don't have to. That's what I'd be doing. I'd have me a pocket full of those GPS locators. Be slapping out on these cars.
Yeah, that probably makes things a lot easier nowadays.
Oh my God! Yeah, you can sit in your office and see where they went, but. But yeah, those guys that do that kind of stuff, they're just almost impossible to follow. They're really, really religious about it. Usually what happens is they get lazy. They mm-hmm. relax a little bit. And if they let their guard down a little bit, then you got them. But the ones that don't ever relax, they're almost impossible to stay on.
And I was talking to Frank Calabrese, and you know, you see in the movies a lot of times these mob guys, they ride around and the cops are after them, and they try and lose them, and then they go about their business after they lose the cops. And what Frank said is you know, you take your steps, you drive down one-way streets, you drive around for an hour and you try and make sure nobody's after you. But if they are, if you see people after you, then you just go home for the day. You don't try and lose them, and then you know somebody's after you, and then you go about doing your business. You know, you figure a town like Chicago is a big place. Well, Rhode Island was a huge mob, and Grasso had several crews underneath him. It's not like he was going to be followed every single day. He had other guys that were underneath him, and he was able to make people too. He was close with Patriarca, so he had a couple guys made. They would be following different guys of it on different days. If he was being followed pretty heavily, he would just go. I imagine, and you could probably speak to this. If you're following somebody pretty hot and heavy, they don't struggle to lose you and then go on and do their business, do they? I mean, they would just go home for that day, wouldn't they? And wait till day.
I think it probably depends on what they're doing. Sure. But a lot of them, if they think they've lost you by there, that, you know, there's only so many hours in a day, mm-hmm. and you got people you got to see and things you got to do. Now, if they were going to go do a hit, or they're getting ready to go like on some kind of a caper of some kind, yeah, they probably would. If they really were focused on something, that now they probably would go on home for the day. But if they're not really focused on anything particularly, they'll just, you know, they may lose you for a while, and then they'll take on off and do their business. That one thing you do also is you get a pattern on people after mm-hmm. a while. So these guys, you kind of know where they're going to show up. So if they start acting like they're hinky, if they act like they're looking for a tail, you just back off and send a couple of cars around to the different places where they might show up. A couple of three cars on down the road a ways, watch a couple of three intersections, just take a chance. And then maybe you pick them back up, you know, two or three miles down the road or at some regular coffee stop or business that they stop in quite often. And all of a sudden you pick them back up down there, and then you're back on them again. So that's, you know, there's all kinds of ways to skin a cat. Unless they're on a specific mission, that like a hit or something, they'll keep doing their business.
I remember you telling the story about one night following Tuffy DeLuna and pulling up next to him at the stoplight, and he looks over and sees you, young fella at late at night in a certain part of town, and not necessarily being a local.
That was one of those times where they went on home mm-hmm. because they were in a stolen car. They were in a car that I had never seen before, and there was a couple other guys with him, and they were in the area where there was a guy that they eventually did kill. But when he saw me, yeah, that was a good example there of them just saying, nope, not today. This is not our day. Let's just go on. We'll come back another day.
Weren't making a social call.
Yeah. Now, if he was just going to use a phone that he didn't really want somebody to know he was using, he might have taken some evasive measures and then go on and go to his telephone. But a lot of times, like that phoning or meeting people, they have these arrangements made mm-hmm. to be at a certain phone at a certain time. In order to do business, they kind of have to keep moving.
Yeah.
I can't just stop every time that they think they see a tail.
What they said about Grasso is he would never speak indoors. You know, they would try and record him.
Smart.
He wouldn't, his guys would go over there. They'd watch football in his home. And they said, you're just sitting there in silence watching football. Just, you would not, wouldn't speak at all for 3 hours. You're sitting there with the guy, wouldn't say a word. They said, you know, you're sitting here with this guy, and at any minute he could explode about anything. And you're in dead silence for 3 hours with this guy who's terrifying. He was a health nut too. They said,
"Oh, really?
He no salt on the food at all. So he's a terribly unpleasant person to be around. He's always blowing up and screaming and yelling." And they said, "Worst of all, he owns this restaurant, but you can't eat with him because his food's is just bland as hell." He dresses like he just dresses in cheap clothes. So everything about the guy was
no.
He lived in a little ranch home in a quiet neighborhood. I mean, everything about the guy was pretty unpleasant. He just ate lousy food and screamed and yelled at his guys. And he took half of their damn money. He demanded half their tribute, and he also half of their income. He also lined up all of the gambling in the area. There were no independent bookmakers. It was a small enough area that he knew everybody from Providence to Connecticut and up to up into Massachusetts, and they all kicked into him a percentage, kind of like in Chicago and other places.
Like Chicago, yeah. They lined everybody up in Chicago. Again, Chicago is probably a bigger area, Chicago in some ways is a big area, but in the areas they were, it's like a small town.
Yeah, everybody knows everybody.
Everybody knows everybody.
Yeah, so he ran everything in Connecticut. He took it over. He eventually, through Patriarca, made some deals. He wanted to expand into Springfield, Springfield, Massachusetts, which is western Massachusetts and just north of Connecticut. But there were some deals made with between Patriarca and the family. So while Patriarca controlled that territory, it was left up. The Genoveses were allowed to operate there. Now, he did have positive relations with the other families. Grasso did. He killed that mobster Frank Piccolo as a favor to Big Paul Castellano. When Colombo boss Carmine and the Snake Persico's son was on the run when he was on the lam in between 1980 and 1987. Grasso hid him out under the name Al Longo in Connecticut. He was a fugitive from the law, and Grasso was his protector and looked out for him. One of Grasso's men, a guy named Bill Grant, was responsible for him financially. Bill Grant complained about having to pay so much money because Persico kept hitting him up. And then when Persico was arrested in 87, everybody thought that Grant must have informed. He disappeared shortly thereafter. So that's another one that Grasso killed one of his own men. He was a big earner for Grasso, multi-million dollar gambling ring. And when Persico was arrested, they immediately killed the guy who was responsible for him. And he also, as a sort of a favor to the Genoveses, he did not expand further into their territory. But what he did do was a lot of their associates, he recruited them into his crews. He took guys away from them. Two of their guys who they were proposing for membership into their Springfield crews, he offered them more money. He brought them in, and he eventually made them as Patriarca men and used them in his crews. So he little dabs at them, just to sort of fuck with the Genoveses. He recruited men from their crew up there, and he made them as Patriarcas, guys that they had pledged for membership. He brought them into his family just to sort of piss them off. He was just generally a kind of an unpleasant, just an asshole, really. So
an ambitious asshole,
absolutely.
And the boss will put up with that because you take a guy like that, And he'll handle problems, and it won't come back and touch you, and he'll make money, and you don't have to do anything.
That's right.
Just let him operate.
Yeah, absolutely. So Patriarca died of a heart attack. He was, you know, kind of like Savella. He had a little bit of jail time behind him, and he was under indictment, and he was facing some real problems. But while he was under indictment, and while he was facing some jail time, he died of a heart attack. So he died of natural causes outside of prison in 1984. And he proposed his son, Raymond Patriarca Jr., to be his successor. And you and I have talked about how historically, whenever these mob guys, and I think that's a Sicilian thing, but other families have done it too. Whenever these mob guys try and have their son take over for them, it never works out very well.
Yeah.
You know, the Bonanos did it, and it led to a real bad war. Persico tried to do it, and it didn't work out for them. It led to a big conflict. Gotti tried to do it, and nobody took his son seriously. It eventually led to a real conflict in the Patriarcas. They had a real power struggle. When Raymond Patriarca Jr. became boss, and Jerry Angiulo went to prison, and he was in prison in 84, Grasso became the underboss. So he was, and they think he was, a lot of people, FBI, considered him to be the real power behind the throne. He was a,
he was the real strong man running the family, because Patriarcha Jr., Ray Jr., was considered to be kind of weak. He wasn't his father, and a lot of guys didn't think he had earned it, so he was doing a lot of real estate business at the time, so he wasn't really focused on running the family. So
interesting. You know, we had two brothers that ran the family here, basically almost like co-bosses, mm-hmm. with one being the lesser of the two equals, and the other one be the greater of the two equals. But their son, the one of them had a son, and he was operational, shall we say, but he never moved into any kind of position of power. It was almost like there was a power vacuum, and mm-hmm. and an outside guy, you know, kind of moved in finally and took over after a while. But the family thing did not work out here either.
Now, I will say, in Detroit, they did keep it between basically three families, the Zerillas and the Tocos and the Giacomos, and between those, those three families, they pretty much ruled throughout the course of that, the what's called the partnership up there. And it worked for them, but I think it worked because those families were so extensive and they were all so close that they were, and they had trained their kids for so long in the life that was one of the exceptions, Detroit, where they did make it work, keeping it in the family.
Like this Grasso, I mean, think about what you've just said about him. Think about his history. He's already consolidated all this power in himself. He's formed connections and relationships with people in the five families. Yeah. I mean, he's positioned. He is the heir apparent, and to move anybody in front of him, that would be like a death sentence, I would think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because he's an ambitious guy, obviously.
Yeah, he. So Grasso was sort of running things between Connecticut and Rhode Island, and that's you have Cadillac Frank Salim, who's become kind of a famous guy later on. Cadillac Frank Salim was running things in Boston. So you got these two pretty big powerhouses, who are both close to Raymond Patriarcha Jr., and they're running the family, Grasso and Frank Salim. And they've got the market pretty much cornered in the Patriarcha family. And the way they're running things and the way they've got Ray Jr. sort of kowtowed is making other people in the family really unhappy. They don't like the influence they've got. They don't like that these two guys are running things and not sharing power. So a couple capos, Joseph Russo, J.R. Russo, and sort of a lesser capo, Vincent the Animal Ferrara, are not as close to Patriarcha. They're not liking that they have a little less power under these two guys. So they are kind of chomping at the bit. They're not happy. So the consigliere at the time, a guy named Ilario Larry Bione Zanino, he's real respected. He's an old school guy. He's pretty powerful, but he goes to prison around about 1987, and he advises Patriarcha Jr. He says, look, this guy, this Joseph Russo, he's a powerful capo. He's probably one of your big hitters. So if you want to keep the peace in the family, you need to make him the consigliere. So you've got Grasso as the underboss and Cadillac Frank Salim running things out of Boston. You got to make this J.R. Russo the consigliere, and that'll back him off. And that'll keep the peace, because Russo doesn't like Grasso and he doesn't like Salim. But if you give him some power, we can maybe keep things calm. Also what's going on is without Patriarcha Sr., Grasso has started expanding his gambling empire into Springfield. He's been trying to take over the Genovese turf a little. He's expanding into vending machines up there, and he's not following the truce that had taken place. So He is taking away some business from the Genoveses, and he's pissing them off. He's this Carlo Mastrototaro, who was in charge of this town Worcester. Worcester. He's I can never pronounce those damn towns in Massachusetts.
Worcester. I think it's Worcester. Yeah, I know what you mean.
But he's expanding into Genovese territory and getting into this guy Carlo Mastrototaro, and they're starting to butt heads. And a guy named Frank Scabelli, who's the head capo up there, they're having some real problems with Grasso. He's starting to butt heads with the Genovese. So without that Patriarca Senior to rein things in, Grasso is really starting to, they called him Wild Guy for a reason. He's starting to really take over. So Grasso is making enemies out of Russo, who's a big capo in the family. He's also making enemies with the Genovese family out of Springfield, Massachusetts. And he's got a weak boss, Patriarca Jr., who really doesn't have much power. In addition, you've got Frank Salim in Boston, who nobody really likes. And he's partnered with the Irish, which a lot of people also don't like. A lot of the traditional Italians don't like that Frank Salim is close to guys like Whitey Bulger, but he works across the board. So Frank Salim is also unpopular. So the whole regime is not very popular with the more traditional guys like Joseph Russo. So things are starting to come to a head in Rhode Island. You've got a lot of forces pointed at Grasso right now. So it's really, really getting hot up there in Grasso.
And he's not the most popular cat in the sandbox either.
That's right. His own men, Grasso's own men, don't like him either. He's been.
I was going to say, now, that would be where I'd turn to look for somebody to set him up.
His own men are hating him too. So he's just surrounded by people who do not like him, Grasso.
Yeah.
So in the end, that does those three things do him in. June 16th, 1989, early morning, Frank Salim in Boston is walking into a pancake house. Car pulls up and just starts unloading, shooting at him. He's hit a couple times. He runs across the parking lot and dives into a pizza shop. And so he's still alive, but he's hit a couple times, and he ends up in the hospital. Then 4 hours later in Connecticut, Grasso is found floating in the Connecticut River with a shot in the head. So you've got the two major powers in the Patriarca family within a couple hours of each other are both found dead, one of them in north of Boston, one of them in Connecticut. So these are pretty well-calculated hits. Now, another thing about this Russo, he's the guy that killed Joseph Barbosa, who was an informant. He went out to Las Vegas and killed him. So this Russo is a real calculating. He's a real killer. He has a whole hit squad of people underneath him. But Grasso is a very, very suspicious guy. He's not somebody who would have gotten into a car with anybody he doesn't know. And he wouldn't leave town. He wouldn't just go anywhere. So what happened was, Grasso was told that the Genoveses wanted to meet with him, this Carlo Mastrototaro, who was a capo. So he said he wanted to meet with him to discuss vending machine territory up in Massachusetts. They wanted to meet on safe territory, and Grasso knew that he was being watched and being listened to, so he wanted to drive up to their territory where it would be safe. He got in the car with four of his own guys, and they're driving down I-91 on the interstate, because he would feel safe in a car with four of his own people. And they shot him in the back of the head on the interstate going 75 miles an hour.
Are you shitting me?
No shit. Shot him in the head driving down the interstate.
Somebody grab the wheel.
That's right.
I could hear that conversation just for that. Okay. You know, you sit behind him, you know, Joe, you sit behind him, and Tony, you're going to sit up front next to him, but you grab the wheel when I pop him, okay?
And I hope they had the damn windows down, because you know a gunshot in a car
it'd be loud, yeah.
So
Grasso says, well, how come you guys are putting those earplugs in? Cam, if you get some guys in the car with you and you're going somewhere and they start putting their earplugs in, pull over, get out, and just walk away.
Guys, I gotta hit the head. Can y'all pull over at this next rest area?
I wouldn't wait that long. I'd slam on the brakes, right, open the door, and roll out before it even came to a stop. They start putting their earplugs in.
So you got, I mean, you had a three-prong attack. You had the Genovese set. I mean, this Russo.
Yeah, really. They set him up.
You had the Genovese's.
And somebody else had already got it. To these guys,
yeah,
said it was okay. You know, you got the approval of somebody back in New York, and you'll be rewarded for this.
Yeah, so Patriarca Jr. is now he's all alone, and he reaches out to Gotti, who says, I don't know, you got to handle this on your own. And
I don't know, I don't know nothing. Yeah. I don't know.
Gotti's like, Gotti tells him, I tell you what, I'll support the winner.
There you go.
So that's the best I can do for you. So
good luck.
Russo says, all right, tell you what, you make me underboss and you let me make a few guys. Let's make four guys and I'll bring an end to this. So we'll end this little war. So we'll end the war of succession. So Patriarca Jr. says, okay. All right. So they decide to get together and they make four guys in a place called Medford, Massachusetts. It's just outside of Boston. It's a lot of mob guys live in Medford, and they have for a lot of years. And the reason this is a famous ceremony is because one of the four guys being made was working for the FBI.
No, this is the one they
This is the one they recorded.
Taped. Wow.
He found out ahead of time where it was going to be. They set up the recording apparatus, and the FBI recorded this mob ceremony. And this is the first time they ever recorded anybody being made. So this just crushed them shortly thereafter.
How embarrassing!
Oh my God!
So embarrassing! Oh my God! You couldn't show your face at an Italian restaurant again, could you?
Right? Bunch of mob guys having to buy their own dinner. So that they lost face in front of the whole just the entire country.
Really, you know, they've never released that tape.
No, yeah, that's here,
I can tell you why it'll never be released unless somebody's able to snatch it, because under Title III, the only way they're hugely secret, and the only way it can ever be released if it's ever used in a court proceedings. And entered as evidence, then it can be released. And it's probably, there's not been a court proceeding based that needed that as evidence. So if it's not ever introduced into court as an exhibit, it won't ever be released. By law, they can't.
You know, I think there's still court cases going on around it, whether or not because I know there was a lot of issues as far as whether or not they had reason to set up the recording. I know there was a lot of problems surrounding that, and I need to do more reading. But there was a lot of argument about whether or not they had taken the proper procedures to set up the recording device, if they had proper reason to, if they had taken the proper steps, or if they just set up surveillance and got the warrant under false pretenses. There was a lot of argument about that, and I think it had run up through appeals, and I think that there's still some debate about that. And I know Frank Salim was in witness protection recently, and he only, I think it was this year, the end of last year, was arrested in witness protection for a murder he committed in 94 of a nightclub owner. And I think he's still contesting that ceremony when somebody was something to do with that ceremony, because it had something to do with the family. But there was still some court battle about it. I mean, they fought the hell out. They didn't want that.
Yeah, they don't want it out. No, and if they can keep it out, then it'll never get released.
That's right. So
interesting.
But yeah, that.
And I always wondered how that came about. Yeah. Now I know. The Salim, you say he was in witness protection. Was he the one that set it up to be?
No, he wouldn't. He ended up.
He's the one trying to keep it out.
Yeah,
wonder who it was that set it up.
I think he said that eventually led to one of his prosecutions or something. The guy who set it up was one of the guys being made, and they didn't tell anybody where it was going to be held. It was a secret location, and then I think it was held in somebody's sister's house, and I think they found out the guy being made found out at the last minute. You know, go to this house. And he told the FBI, and they set up the recording device the day before it happened or something. They found out at the last minute where it was going to be. It was one of the guys being made. I can't remember his name. I don't know. It's got it ends with a vowel, and it's probably a Joseph or a Paul or a Tony, and it ends with a vowel. That's all I can remember.
Yeah, I got you.
But and then shortly thereafter, there was a huge indictment of the patriarchal family. They said it was the largest single law enforcement action against one crime family ever, and they've never really recovered. And you know, you don't hear much about them anymore because they've all but been wiped out. So
interesting.
And yeah,
thus has ended many of the crime families in the United States, and they're still limping along here in Kansas City, and I know they are in Chicago, and I'm sure they are in Boston particularly, but may not be so much in New Haven and Providence. I bet Boston still has something. Kind of those big, great big cities lend themselves more to that kind of action than the smaller, more mid-sized towns. I was always surprised what the deal was with Raymond Patriarca and controlling all that, including Boston and all of New England out of basically the little town of Providence, Rhode Island.
There was a recent bust.
He must have been a heck of a guy.
Yeah, he was. He was a hell of a planner, and he was a smart guy. He wouldn't hesitate, and he could be very brutal. But I think that he butted heads with Carlo Gambino a little bit is what I've read. But I think that, you know, that was just mostly just a pissing contest like a lot of these guys get into. But, you know, like all of them, he could be very brutal when he had to be. But he held that family for 30 years and he held off the five families and he commanded respect from them. So, you know, he was doing something right. He didn't pay tribute to any of them, and they got his permission before they operated on his territory. So, and for 30 years, he died of natural causes. And the only prison sentence he had, it was a false testimony given, and it was set up by an FBI agent, and he was later released because it was a setup. And so, you know, he was never charged.
Interesting. Well, that's a pretty interesting story about Patriarca. I didn't know much about him, and I don't know. I've never done a show on the New England mob, and now we've got a couple of them. Mm-hmm. And Cam, I really appreciate you doing all this research and bringing that to the fans out there, the wiretappers. I know they appreciate it. I even on one of the little Venmo things, I don't remember which one it was now, said that he really enjoys the shows, especially the ones with Cam in it. Was that your brother-in-law?
that's right. I told some people to please give me a little bit of recognition. That's great. You know, otherwise I'd just be sitting alone bothering my wife with this stuff, you know?
Yeah. Well, you got a whole lot of people out there that are really interested in it, and I am too, and we'll continue this collaboration over the next year or two, whatever. I don't know how much longer I'll do this, but I'm still having fun with it, and I'll just keep plugging away.
I really enjoy doing it with you, and I really thank you for the opportunity.
All right, Cam. Well, folks, if you have a friend or relative that has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. Now it's time for my little commercial broadcast here for myself. Since we don't have any sponsors, you notice we don't really interrupt our show for anything, but we do a little bit here at the very end. If go out and get my movie, Gangland Wire. You can download it for $1.99 from Amazon, or if you want the DVD with the special effects, go to my website, ganglandwire.com, and get ordered off of that. My book, Leaving Vegas, How FBI Wiretaps Ended Mob Domination of Las Vegas Casinos. I would suggest you get the Kindle version. I think I forgot to say that before, because I have all the wiretaps that I used, all the transcripts of the wiretaps that I used in the skimming trials are linked to the Kindle version, the actual audio from those wiretaps. You can hear the people, the real people, say the words that they're not just read them. This is the true story behind the movie Casino. If you want to take a mob tour of Kansas City, get my Kansas City Mob Tour app on the Apple Store, the Apple App Store. I think that's all I got. We're going to do another Mob Festival in November, a Mob Film Festival in November. My friend Terrence O'Malley, he's got a new movie it's a piece of video that he's cabbaged onto of a mob guy in Kansas City. It was in witness protection, came back to the city, and then drove around with a friend with a video camera and just, you know, kind of gave his own little mob tour. And this happened here and that happened there. It's kind of interesting. And I'm working on my movie about the Savella family versus the Spiro family, a famous mob war we had in Kansas City in the 70s. And it'll be ready by that point in time. And I guess I'm about petered out with all my commercials here, Cam. I really appreciate you doing this. And we will talk to you soon.
Thank you, Gary.
Music provided by our good friend and super fan from Portland, Oregon, Casey McBride. Thanks, Casey.
Oh, I know. I worked in a union up at the Ford plant, an automotive plant.
There you go.
I know. Anything like that. They are against it. What do you think about these poor policemen? They run around, they're camered up and mic'd up everywhere they go. I shudder to think of some of the shit I said and did back in the day. We had a deal one night. And,
what's that?
Policeman, he got voice, a guy mean? Resisted or whatever, and he was by himself. And we all got
there.
He got a message out on the radio, and we all got there, and he's on the ground scuffling around this guy. He's a pretty good sized guy. So about four of us get there, and we kind of wrestle.
I don't know all these damn apps.
But, you know, it didn't look good. It never looks good. And so we get him put in the wagon, and about, you know, 5 minutes after the wagon leaves, some dude shows up with one of those, it was right after the Rodney King thing, and some dude shows up with a little handheld camera going, "What's going on?" I'm going, "Oh my God." Went back to station, told the captain, I said, "I don't know if he got anything or what it looks like. It wasn't bad, I promise, Cap. It wasn't bad, but it probably didn't look very pretty."
Yeah.
Yeah. And believe me, seeing something on a video, everybody says, "Oh, well, we saw it." Well, seeing it on the video is not like being there. It has no relation to being there at all.